You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. We're starting off today at the Gaslight. It's a bar on Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica whose neon sign boasts world-class karaoke every night of the week. Even on a weeknight, there's a group of folks ready to grab that mic. A man is posted right at the door asking for IDs and vaccination cards from anyone who walks in. Know what he's not checking for? Masks. Nobody's wearing them, not even the bartender or the guy running the karaoke machine in the back.
Amazing. It fills my heart with hope.
Eric Fedida says he feels safe and he's ready to strip off that mask now that COVID hospitalizations are dropping.
I feel like we've done enough to the point where I can see, like, around me, less and less people are getting it. I don't know exactly why. I can't really explain it, but the numbers are the numbers, right?
Public health officials agree with them. 2 weeks ago, California and later L.A. County lifted mask requirements for almost all indoor settings for vaccinated people. Well, this Friday, unvaccinated Angelenos get to join them in tossing their masks in most places. That's got some folks, like Fedida, celebrating. But it's got others feeling nervous. KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
Walking into the karaoke bar felt like I was walking into 2019. I was immediately conscious of being the only one wearing a mask. Everyone else was soaking up their new normal. At one point, I felt one person's spit land on my hand holding the outstretched microphone, and I was shouting muffled questions behind the comfort of my pandemic-era security blanket. Standing next to the performers was Desmond Perez, and he might be one of the biggest fans of the recent move to lift indoor masking requirements.
It brings us a sense of normality that I think we've been craving, but have been hesitant to admit because of the benefits of the mask, but anyways, it's good. It's just good to be back to somewhat normalcy.
Perez and I had to step outside.
Do you want to go outside or do you want to? I don't mind.
So we could hear each other during a particularly spirited version of REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It.
So it's nice. It's even better to see people's faces and smiling. And before mask mandates, I never appreciated it. And post-mask mandates, you appreciate it a lot more. It's nice to be back to normal somewhat at this point.
Back inside, Aiden Gavas says he's glad to see California's precautions looking more like the rest of the country. He recently moved here from New York, and he says California's rules were some of the most conservative he'd seen.
So we're just, you know, taking it one day at a time and trying to enjoy our time maskless and happy and with people. It's funny because it feels natural. You know what I mean?
So the patrons of the karaoke bar are ready to embrace a maskless world. But not everybody's ready to shed a mask and walk into a crowded bar.
Do you know those people in the karaoke bars? Bless their hearts. More power to them. But yeah, I'm not. Ooh, no.
And that includes Haley Roberts.
Even though we're 2 years in, it just feels very abrupt to be like, okay, never mind. Just like breathe all over each other in enclosed spaces.
Roberts has a young child who's not old enough to be vaccinated. She says for now, she's not going to a theater or a gym, let alone a karaoke bar.
It feels kind of sudden or soon, just given how the cycles of increases in cases and then drops in cases and hospitalizations have gone over the last 2 years. So feels premature.
Hospitalizations in LA County are dropping, but they're about where they were in December at the beginning of the Omicron surge.
Is this really coming from a place of this is what seems to be making sense on a large scale? Or is it a little bit like, well, we're at 2 years, people seem very annoyed by the masks, so maybe let's just drop that barrier.
Roberts is on to something. In mid-February, the CDC said it wanted to, quote, give people a break from things like mask wearing. It's not the first time California lifted its indoor mask mandate. Last summer, COVID case rates dipped to their lowest levels since the beginning of the pandemic. It was just like this until case rates spiked again and the mask mandate came back in the fall. Roberts says she was skeptical of the easing of restrictions last time, too. She says on top of vaccines and boosters, she's waiting for more widely available treatment for people who do end up sick in the hospital before she'll be comfortable not wearing a mask. Marie Andrade feels the same way. Today is Andrade's first day back in the office in person as a buyer for a clothing company, and she's masking up.
I have to go into a meeting room and no one in the room is wearing a mask and just like sit in the corner like a weirdo.
She became a lot more careful in 2022 when her family felt the impact of the pandemic firsthand. Her fiancé's father is triple vaxxed, and he's hospitalized with COVID and about to be taken off life support. Meanwhile, Andrade's 50-year-old sister died of COVID last month.
If the last month hadn't have played out the way that it had, I think I would be a little more agreeable. Having seen what's transpired, that kind of defies what the narrative is. I am not feeling super great about it, to be honest.
Even so, she says she gets why some of the people around her are ready to take the risk and shed the mask.
If you're on a diet, right? If you don't get that cheat meal every once in a while, you're probably going to go crazy. So I think giving breaks from some of the protections makes sense, but it's also a Pandora's box. Once you open it up and rescind those mandates, then how do you rein it back in should another surge occur?
She says she'll just keep wearing a mask. And she's predicting this maskless spring will be temporary anyway, like last year, before COVID rates creep up again.
I can't imagine why we wouldn't see another strain come through that is vaccine resistance. It just, what is there to stop it, I guess? I would just look at history and say, well, this is how the trend has been. So what is happening that's going to give us an indication that anything about that's going to change go forward?
Back at the karaoke bar, Gava might be maskless, but he wouldn't be surprised if Andrade turns out to be right.
I mean, I feel like I wish it's not temporary, but who knows? I mean, we're enjoying the moment, right? So for now, it sounds good. I don't see how it's necessarily going away, but, you know, if we could take our masks down even for a little bit, that would be a good, you know, sign of relief. So that's good enough for me at this point.
So for now, he's returned to his local karaoke bar with old friends to discover his new normal. Or at least a good normal for now. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. They're not playing like it right now, but the LA Lakers are arguably one of the highest profile franchises in professional sports. In the 1980s, they were at the top of their game. You had Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, James Worthy. The team won 5 championships in that decade alone under owner Jerry Buss.
God damn. Basketball. I mean, look at it. It's like great sex. It's always moving. It's rhythmic.
That's actor John C. Reilly, who plays Buss in the new HBO series, Winning Time. The series is based on a best-selling book by author Jeff Pearlman called Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Reilly, and the Los Angeles Lakers dynasty of the 1980s. And Jeff is with us right now. Hey, Jeff.
Hello.
Hey. And Rodney Barnes, executive producer and writer of the miniseries, is with us as well. Hey, Rodney.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, we are talking about the Lakers dynasty of the 80s, and Jeff, I'm going to start with you because we all love a good Lakers story. What was it about this particular era that made you want to write a book about it?
Well, I mean, for me, it really, I grew up, I was a kid in New York watching it all on TV when you would get the Lakers, which wasn't that often. And I just really found it as a kid, you're sitting home, they would pan in on the Forum, you know, live from sunny Los Angeles, and you'd see the palm trees outside and they'd show the coastline. And then they'd come inside the Forum and you'd see the Laker girls and you'd see celebrities courtside. And then you'd see Magic smile and the snazzy uniforms and Kareem. And to me, it all just symbolized Hollywood and glamour and glitz and sunshine. And I just think it's a glorious era. And I really was drawn to it.
The old Great Western Forum. And you know, it's funny, Jeff, because your book is called Showtime, and I'm sure HBO didn't want to call it that for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I totally get it. Totally
which they call it Winning Time. Your book came out in 2014, and you sold the rights to it that same year. Why'd it take so long, do you think, to get made?
I just think they all take a long time to get made. And you know, Rodney could probably answer this better than me. It's such a complicated process, and you see how much goes into it, and you see how much these guys, you know, Rodney and Max and Jim and Adam McKay, like you see how much they put into it, and the casting and the writing and the development, and also just getting it someone to bite. You know, like when it was a screenwriter named Jim Hecht who shows up at my house in 2014, and he's like, I really think this could be something. Well, that doesn't mean it's going to be something. You know, you need to get the right people involved, and it just takes a long, long time.
You didn't know who Adam McKay was, right? The director of this series. You had no idea.
I had no idea whatsoever.
No. I mean, Anchorman, Step Brothers, Booksmart, The Big Short. I mean, you know, come on. Rodney, now he brought you into this, so let's get your take on all of this. How'd you get involved with the series? Are you a Lakers fan?
I was a 76ers fan growing up. I was a huge Dr. J fan, still am.
Yeah.
How I became a part of this. I've seen so many bad movies and TV shows about basketball that I wanted to be part of one that I thought had a shot at really being good. And that's kind of what drew me to it. It still keeps me here to this day.
Let's play a clip from the first episode of the show, which premieres, by the way, this weekend. This is when owner Jerry Buss is trying to sign Magic Johnson.
Irvin, that's what I want to do with the Lakers. I want to build something special. But I need a partner.
That mean we got a deal?
Well, I take you out for a nice burger. You just want to hit me again with that? 600 is a lot, let me tell you. Isn't that what the Celtics just paid Larry Bird? Yeah, I see you smiling.
I mean, I don't see the difference between me and him, you know? Except I kind of did whoop his ass for the national championship.
Yeah, you did.
Jeff, the Lakers franchise, I mean, the NBA was sinking. Jerry Buss bought the Lakers, the LA Kings, and the Great Western Forum for $67.5 million, right? That was part cash, part Chrysler building.
Yeah, exactly. Traded the Chrysler building to do it.
So, I mean, what kind of a risk was that at the time? And what was this, the late 1970s? I mean, the league wasn't really making a whole lot of money. No one was that interested in the league at that point. Tell us what was going on at the time.
It was a preposterous thing to do. It was, by 99 out of 100 measures, a really dumb transaction. He was buying into a league that still showed the finals on tape delay. He was buying into a league that was perceived to have a serious drug problem. He was buying into a league at a time period where people considered it, quote unquote, too black for mainstream audiences. He was buying into a league that was losing a lot of money. And I got to say, and it's not exaggerated, and the show does, you know, explains this really, really well. He was a visionary. And he saw the NBA for what it could be. And he saw Magic Johnson for what he could be. And the thing he did that you see nowadays and the imprint that he had is he saw people coming to a basketball game and he really thought they should be coming for an entertainment experience. So when you see teams with dance squads and mascots and music blaring and different restaurants and bars and cafes, That is all the genesis of Jerry Buss coming to the Lakers in 1979.
I mean, he was a show man, right? Like, this is, when you talk about Showtime, he wanted there to be an entertainment aspect to the game. There were players of the Showtime era. Let's make it fancy. Let's make it fun. Let's add music to it. Let's, you know, make it an experience. That's what was going on, right?
100%. And that, I have to say, the genius of Rodney and Max and Jim and all the writers, they capture it perfectly. And I'm not just saying that because I wrote the book. They capture it absolutely perfectly. The time period and the flair and the pizzazz and just the embrace of sort of living and life at that time period. I mean, it just nails it. And that team and that time period really exemplified it. Just this idea of coming to LA and making something of yourself and becoming a star.
We heard in that tape Buss mentioning how the Celtics had just signed Larry Bird for $650,000. The Lakers ended up signing Johnson the same year for about $500,000 a year, $500,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. That was a coast-to-coast rivalry for a long time, wasn't it?
Well, it started in college when they played each other in the NCAA championship. And I think both of them getting drafted to the places that they went to made for perfect theater. You know, Boston, the personality of Boston juxtaposed to the personality of L.A. It just made for great theater. And I think Dr. Buss making the changes that he made at that time and fates of the universe kind of falling into alignment, pitting these guys against each other, it was perfect.
You think there was a racial aspect to all of this?
It was a race. Do I think? It certainly was a racial aspect of it. I mean, I think Boston at that time had a certain reputation. And I think L.A. had a different kind of stigma attached to it that was the complete opposite. And so I think the media played on those two ideas. I always felt like it felt like Jerry Cooney versus Larry Holmes. Like it had this great white hope thing that was attached to it for Larry Bird, that he was going to come back and sort of recapture the game that these guys, these black guys, had sort of taken over.
Well, recapture the game for white people.
Yes, exactly. Civilize the game again.
And yet now, Rodney and Jeff, the NBA, I mean, we're talking worth billions of dollars. Franchises, you know, everything's standing room only to go to a game, right?
It is. I certainly think the game has evolved to a place where, you know, when we start the show in 79, the ABA has merged into the NBA. And I think with Jack McKinney in our show, sort of taking that idea of street ball and chaos and bringing structure to it. And I think Magic was a great ambassador of that as well. And so when you look at how hip hop, the emergence of hip hop music during the 80s and into the 90s, and then guys like Allen Iverson as well, taking the fashion of that idea and sort of incorporating it into pop culture and young people grabbing a hold of it. It sort of made basketball cool. And I think it's evolved from that place into what we see today.
Well, the new series premieres this Sunday on HBO. Rodney Barnes, executive producer of the HBO show Winning Time, and Jeff Perlman, author of the book Showtime, on which Winning Time is based. Thanks to you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Art is an expression. Sometimes it's an expression of identity or a story or a feeling. Whatever it is, it can be a vessel that communicates an artist's story to an audience, and it can have the power to change perspectives. Well, a couple of new exhibitions in L.A. are exploring vastly different takes on expression. Woman House at Anat Ebgi and Diedrich Brackens at Craft Contemporary. Our art insider is here to tell us all about them. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, editor-in-chief at Carla, Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hey, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
I want to start with Woman House. This is actually a restaging, right, of an older show from the 1970s, from decades ago. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this original Woman House exhibition is a very kind of Southern California story. It came out of the feminist art program, which was at CalArts in the 70s. It was a program run by Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapiro. And in 1972, together with a bunch of their female students, they found this dilapidated 17-room mansion in Hollywood and kind of took it upon themselves to fix up this house, do a bunch of renovations. And then each room in this house became an art installation. So there were installations in the closets and the bathrooms. There were eggs on the walls that became breasts. And there was an installation about menstruation in the bathroom. So it was a very kind of visceral expression of feminist art making at that time. And a lot of it really had to do with the female body and domestic labor. And so having an exhibition like this in a home, not in an art gallery, really kind of heightened those themes. And, you know, the show had thousands of visitors. It was only up for a month. It got national coverage in Time magazine. So it really kind of brought this conversation of feminist practice into a more national conversation. And of course, now Woman House has become just a huge touchstone within art history, and specifically for, you know, this really cool Southern California legacy that we have of feminist art here.
So why do you think, Lindsay, that Anat Ebgi wanted to do, you know, a redux, like let's do it again decades later of this now?
Well, the show happened in January 1972. So here we are 50 years later. So it's actually a 50-year anniversary of Woman House. It also kind of conveniently aligned with the Frieze Week, Frieze exhibition. So I think that was another big driver to kind of do this show in this kind of early months of the year. But, you know, I think it is a good time to revisit the legacy of these artists and the impact that they've all had on contemporary art. And I should mention the exhibition isn't necessarily a redo of the original. It was the first one was much more about installation and environments. And the current show does feel much more like a gallery exhibition. You have paintings, drawings, photographs, sculptures from several of the key artists that participated in the original Woman House exhibition. But the show organizers really specifically wanted to show work from these artists before that 1972 exhibition and also after. So they kind of wanted to show a broader range of these artists' work and really show how their work has informed our current conversations around feminism.
All right. So we're gonna switch gears and talk about Craft Contemporary from Diedrich Brackens, which is very different. Brackens is a weaver, right?
Yeah, really beautiful weavings. He mixes different tapestry techniques. So his weavings include figures and objects, so they're pictorial in a way. And they become really narrative and almost an allegorical or symbolic way. And, you know, he's pulling from his own autobiography a bit. He grew up in Texas, but he also looks to larger political events and themes around African-American and queer identity. This show specifically focuses on Diedrich's use of the catfish, the humble catfish, which is a symbol that he actually employs a lot in his weavings. And I think for Diedrich, the catfish refers to a certain type of resilience. You know, we think of catfish as this type of bottom feeder, but they're also very resilient. They can live up to 20 years. And I found out researching this that they're found off almost every continent. So they're kind of, they've spread across the world. And, you know, I think for Diedrich, this catfish almost becomes like a spirit guide in his weavings.
And his poetry is also featured, right, alongside the weaving. So there are words that go along with all of this.
Yeah, it's really interesting to kind of do that here. I've known Diedrich's work for a while, but this is the first time I've seen his poetry. And then to kind of put it in the exhibition space, I think having language present in the show really allows these narratives and the weavings to come to life, literally threading kind of threads and language together, another kind of weaving metaphor there into a personal language. And, you know, again, his poems touch on personal history, political events, themes of police brutality, but they also have this really lovely tenderness to them. There's kind of a magical realism to them.
Which piece in the show stood out to you most?
Yeah, so kind of across the show, there's this recurring motif of threes. There's one weaving with three silhouettes. In others, it's three catfish. And this number three for Diedrich represents an event that took place in 1981 in his hometown, where three black teenagers actually drowned in a Texas lake while in police custody after being arrested at a Juneteenth celebration. And so this is an event and a story that Diedrich kind of grew up hearing about, and it was very impactful for him. So there's one piece in particular that pictures these three silhouettes, and they're sort of being submerged into water, and there's catfish kind of swirling around them. And then paired with the poetry, it's just a really kind of powerful symbolic image. And again, I think here for Diedrich, the catfish becomes a symbol of resilience, almost rebirth in the face of injustice and brutality.
Well, Diedrich's show is up at Craft Contemporary through May 8th. Woman House is up at a temporary space on Fountain Avenue in Hollywood, and that goes through April 16th. Lindsay Preston-Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to share a glass of red, perhaps a Pinot or a Cab Sav, and find out how, in the wake of hard seltzers, sweet sodas, and non-alcohol, vineyards are trying to keep the young folks in their purview. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Online anytime, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Grab the podcast while you're there, or get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Andrea Bautista, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.